Coming up on Boston Public Radio, tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. And who could have predicted how far the country would have come so fast? Maybe Sue O'Connell of Bay Windows. She'll join us and we'll invite you in, too. Then Callie Crossley will describe how three Boston city councilors chose not to honor the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. Then Emmett Price and Edgar B. Herrick III and you go head-to-head-to-head on the new, it's odd to say, new Michael Jackson album.
All right, well then, while I'm sitting in for Marjorie, Jim says that's no excuse for skipping a week of Emily's List, so I won't.
Great.
And on the Friday news quiz, Rick Roth takes on Rick Roth. One works with snakes and other scary animals, and so does the other one. Should make for an interesting contest. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Jim Browdy. She is not Marjorie again, because
no.
Marjorie is off till Monday. She would be Emily Rooney.
Hello.
Hello there, Emily.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Nice to have you back.
Thanks.
So, 10 years ago tomorrow, Massachusetts became the first state to say we do to gay marriage, issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. It was a groundbreaking moment that has paved the way for other states to legalize gay marriage. 17 states plus the District of Columbia in total. Here with us in Studio 3 to recall that morning when soon-to-be newlyweds got their marriage licenses and to look to the future is Sue O'Connell. Sue, of course, is the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Hello there, Sue.
Hey there.
Happy anniversary.
Yeah, really.
Exactly.
So it was not even when we say the morning, because it was actually 12:01.
Yes.
People started lining up. We had crews there from
right.
Greater Boston. And we actually went over to Cambridge. That was seems
right.
where all the action was. Where were you?
Yeah, Mayor Sullivan in Cambridge decided to sort of steal Mayor Menino's lunch and
yeah.
Started offering
yes.
The application for marriages and also waiving the period.
Waiving the three-day
the
waiting
three-day period.
Period.
So on Sunday, it was a Monday that the anniversary yeah. The marriages would start. On Sunday, you know, a couple of lesbians in lawn chairs
yeah.
that were engaged got in front of the door and the line began. And then by about 8 o'clock that night on Mass Ave, you know, and I look back on it, and Cambridge
yeah.
was such a great place because it's homey. You
yes.
know, it's a small place. It's an old building. It's, you know, Mass Ave is not that wide. You know, it's just a four-lane road. And the international press was unbelievable. I think I was overwhelmed by that. And people started lining up, and they had a ceremony inside. And by midnight, folks started getting married. I remember I was in Mayor Sullivan's office and broadcasting there for WFNX, which was on at the time. And I looked out the window to see all the crowd, and I leaned forward, and they had a police officer with me, and I was just really struck by the joy. And he pulled me back in and said, "Don't do that again." And he pointed up, and there were snipers lined all, police snipers lined all along the road in anticipation that there would be something bad happening. Hmm. So by the time the good stuff happened, it was just this great.
Well, there was
moment.
Something bad happening. As we were reminiscing a couple of minutes ago, the I don't even know how to describe them. The Westboro Baptist Church
yes.
was represented across the street.
Just a few, though. I remember there were just a handful, and they were in the First Amendment section.
They
remember
were across,
they
right across
the First Amendment.
Yeah.
And I got to speak to the daughter, who was, I think I'm not alone in saying, one of the sickest
yeah.
People I have ever encountered. But I think when you said a minute, I don't think the weddings actually started until that morning. Wasn't
right.
it 9
yeah,
a.m. or
yeah,
something?
AM, but they had
they
the
were
first
issuing licenses.
And, yep.
and it turns out you hugged a terrific person.
I hugged you.
You did. That's
I
exactly
did.
Right.
I mean, I didn't know really Jim on a hugging level, but I was just so moved, and I hugged him.
Yeah,
you know.
Sure.
But I remember walking up the stairs, you know, Mary Bonato,
yeah.
the lawyer for the gay and lesbian advocates and defenders, came down, and it was just this, like, you know, no one really knew her. She's walking down the front steps, and it's before everything started, and I walked up, and I just said, "Oh, my God, you did it." And she said, "No, we did it. Everyone did it." And
so
it was just great, you know.
Last night, I spoke to Julie and Hillary
yep.
Goodrich, and they were one of six couples who was on the original court filing, who actually, their name became, let's face it, synonymous with the ruling. So they were describing to me last night what it was like when Boston Mayor
right.
Tom Menino escorted them
mm-hmm.
to get their licenses. Here's what they said.
You know, he was so sweet. He walked us through the bowels of City Hall and escorted us up and walked with us to the counter. I mean, it was very, very moving mm-hmm. and very exciting. You know, we were faced with you know, scaffoldings of media from around the world who were following the story.
How carefully chosen were the Goodriches? I was reading, The Globe did a terrific thing with the plaintiff couples, and each of them, they asked them a bunch, you know, two or three fairly simple but perfect questions. They looked the role, the couples.
Yep.
They all had the perfect answers.
Yep.
Obviously, it was pretty carefully calculated choices,
obviously,
right?
I wasn't involved in it, but the one of the phrases I learned through this experience was, you know, good plaintiffs make good law.
Sure.
You know, and
I asked them about that.
Yeah,
I did.
Each of the couples had their unique story about why they should not be denied the right to get married. And I think in the end, it proved the adage.
What did they say to you about that?
They knew that they were the poster children for this, but they had a message, and it was the unity of family, and they were recounting that horror story when they
when the daughter was born, that one of them could not visit the other, and there was a problem.
This was the story they took to Mitt Romney, thinking that they were convinced they were going to bring him over to their side. They were just dumbfounded when he kept referring to their daughter as their adopted daughter.
Yep.
Julie gave birth.
Right. And asked, why didn't they think about, you know, what are we supposed to tell our daughter? And he basically replied, why didn't you think about that before?
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and I think that the stories that each of the plaintiffs had are stories that we found most citizens could relate to. I mean, nobody in their right mind really wants you not to be there in a medical emergency. I mean, that was always the early thing that the Republicans would say, you know, well, you can have the right to burial. You can have the right to hospital visitation. You know, and those were the stories that GLAAD was able to put together.
Well, you know, we're talking to Sue O'Connell. And by the way, if you want to join in this conversation, because tomorrow is a pretty important anniversary, feel free to join Emily, me, and Sue at 877-301-8970. You can talk about that day 10 years ago or the day 10 and a half years ago when the SJC came down with its decision, or what you think of the last 10 years, which we're going to get to in a minute, which has been staggering in terms of activity and development. I don't know where I was going, but now I'm going to go maybe somewhere else. If there was no Goodriche case, well, I opened by saying 17 states in the District of Columbia have same-sex marriage through a variety of ways, some legislative, some judicial, some popular initiative with the voters themselves. If the Goodriche decision hadn't come down like it came down, where would we be on whatever day this is, May 16th of 2014?
There's a broader question, Jim, which is one of those things that's going to be the footnote to history. If the lawmakers in Massachusetts had allowed civil unions to happen in Massachusetts, where would we be? We would probably not have marriage.
Because it would have mollified enough people.
You know, Finneran and former Speaker Finneran and a number of other lawmakers did not want to move forward on allowing any rights for civil unions to Massachusetts residents. And what ended up happening is that's how they crafted the call for marriage rights, because of the way the state constitution is written, that it does not specify a man and woman. And that opened up that. So, I can't imagine this, more of an alignment of what has happened in Massachusetts that brought the marriage equality here. I mean, if one player had been out of place, it probably wouldn't
happen. Was it 4-3? The decision was a 4-3 decision.
It's a 4-3 decision, and you had the mass equality, the old mass equality on the ground ready to go ahead. You had Marty Walsh, who was a key player behind the scenes, Mayor Marty Walsh, who was then a state rep, making people feel more comfortable with the idea. I mean, it's just an enormous number of little cogs that came together to deliver.
I was going to remind people of what the arguments against this were. And really what people were saying is that this is the beginning of the devolution of the family. And so this is Evan Riley from 10 years ago. She's with the Massachusetts Family Institute.
If we do not reverse this through the constitutional amendment, this country is going to be in dire straits in the next generation.
You know, and Evelyn we are,
Murphy.
Obviously.
Yeah, so. We are. She's right. Evelyn Murphy.
The predictions have all come true.
Who told me I was on
Evelyn,
air.
Evelyn Riley.
I'm sorry, Evelyn Riley. I was on air with on Jim's show. He wasn't there, but she kept saying that, you know, all gay people are mentally ill. They're all mentally ill.
And with you sitting there?
Me sitting there. I said, I want you to address me and tell me, am I mentally ill? And she said, well, your womanhood hasn't fully developed. And I said, I don't know. Well, you know, I'm not showing you that again. But
you know, I realized what I was going to say to you before. I literally remember talking about this with with you on and off air, Sue O'Connell, 8, 9, 10 years ago. And what we would cite at the time when a majority of Americans did not support gay marriage, and now they do, as I'm sure people know, the part of the polling that always hit me is the only two subsets of the American population who supported gay marriage in strong numbers were young people and, you know, 60, 70, 80% even then. Now it's in the 80s with millennials. But secondly, and this was always the significant thing to me, people who said they knew a gay person. I mean, it was as soon as you I thought of this because of what you said before about choosing the plaintiffs, when the people could hear their stories and hear they were just like them and just like their neighbors. And they were you, essentially. And that was the bottom line. When people the fear of the unknown gave way to the lack of fear to knowing and loving your neighbor. And that began. And that's ultimately, I guess, what's led to the fact that, what is it, 55% of all Americans, which is stunning to me. Actually support same-sex marriage.
The places that we were losing, like in Maine, which we now do, but it's when the message was not about the people. You know, there was this great lesbian couple who had a son who was a hockey player, and he did a great commercial in Maine, a TV spot, saying, look, these are my hockey moms. I want them to be able to get married. If you make the argument on terms of the constitutionality or, you know, the legal rights, folks don't really get it. Back in Hawaii, where this really started, back in the early
1993,
you know, the argument was about the Constitution, because the folks running the show at that time felt that an argument about the Constitution to many of the Japanese-American people who lived in Hawaii was really going to resonate. But guess what? It doesn't, because they didn't know any gay people.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Tomorrow's the 10th anniversary of the first same-sex marriages in Massachusetts. And if you want to reminisce, that's fine. And by the way, if you're unhappy with the developments, it's fine if you join us as well. You know, it's not just the numbers. And before we get to the calls, would you have ever believed if we had spoken, which we apparently did since we were hugging on Mass Ave 10 years ago, if I had said to you, let's fast forward 10 years, how many states will have emulated Massachusetts? There were a bunch of constitutional amendments already, more constitutional amendments banning gay marriage to come. You would never have said 17 and D.C., right?
No, I felt like the dominoes had started.
Did you really?
Well, I felt there was an inevitability, and I kept using the word inevitability, and activists kept telling me to stop using the word inevitability. But I just think that some of the states that are sort of just flipping the switch as quickly as they can, and obviously the Supreme Court's decision on the Defense of Marriage Act and the Prop 8 status has really made it easier for a lot of these states. But I am shocked at the middle of America that's really just trying to.
When you look at that map, it's still entrenched, you know.
But you've got
Wyoming,
so
today, Idaho, and
Idaho.
Arkansas are where the debates are going.
Did you hear what the governor went nuts?
Which
Idaho. Yes.
What's his name? Otter Cubby?
Otter something. You know, by the way, before we get to the phone calls, I think we have an obligation to hear the voice of the woman who was at the center of this thing, Margaret Marshall, whom we all know. Here is former Chief Justice Marshall on Greater Boston, which just happens to be Emily's show, on the day the Defense of Marriage Act was overturned by, obviously, the U.S. Supreme Court. Marshall said that the Goodrich case, which obviously she wrote, paved the way for overturning DOMA. Listen.
Goodrich, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, was, in a sense, the necessary prerequisite. What the Supreme Court did today, and it's terribly important, required some states somewhere to recognize same-sex marriage, and Massachusetts did.
So, matter of fact, and speaking of matter of fact, some of the first lines of the Goodrich decision, obviously written by Chief Justice Marshall, the Massachusetts Constitution affirms the dignity and equality of all individuals. It forbids the creation of second-class citizens.
Yeah. There are so many weddings where that is read.
Is that so?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have not attended a marriage between same-sex couples that has not been read.
You know, we said a minute ago, without Goodrich, where would we be? Without Margaret Marshall, where would we be? And also, where would we be? I mean, nobody believes that Barack Obama, at least I don't, has ever opposed gay marriage. In fact, as a state senator, he filled out a questionnaire saying he supported it, and then he was opposed to it. And then even people like David Axelrod, chief advisor, says, I think we know in his heart he is there. The story a couple of months ago in the New York Times about the 30-something gay activist who corners Joe Biden at a party at a cocktail party, a fundraiser, asks him a question, which leads Biden basically to say, yeah, we're there.
Yeah.
And then he says it on TV the next day, which puts Obama in a position where he can't keep evolving. Yeah. He's got to be evolved. I mean, that obviously, the fact that President of the United States, even if you don't, if one doesn't support him individually, that creates an umbrella under which these state decisions make so much more sense and are so much easier.
Well, they
no?
do. They do, absolutely. But it also from the people. I mean, to have the mayor of Boston, the mayor of Cambridge, the governor, the president of the United States be supportive totally gives a lot of folks cover. You know, there are a lot of folks who might be ambivalent or don't care, but it allows them. And what it does for the children of gay parents is also just completely incalculable. I mean, for my daughter to see the president of the United States being supportive of same-sex marriage totally makes a big difference.
Art, I'm sorry, again, 877-301-8970. I'm sorry I interrupted you, Emily. Did I not?
No,
did
you,
I?
No.
Well, I will interrupt you then. Let's take a few phone calls. John, you were in JP. You're on Boston Public Radio with Emily Rooney, me, and Sue O'Connell. Hi there, John.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Everyone.
Hi.
How are you, Sue?
Great.
Sue.
Good. No, it wasn't a question. It was a statement that I just kind of wanted to make, something that I noticed after same-sex marriage had passed. What I noticed was in Bay Windows specifically, Bay Windows at the time had been a two-section newspaper. Mm-hmm. About a month, maybe not even a month after same-sex marriage had passed, there was a third section added to the paper.
Mm-hmm.
The third section was all the businesses that now sort of could appeal to the gay and lesbian community that they probably couldn't appeal to before, not just and because of same-sex marriage. And it wasn't just like florists and banquet hall chauffeurs. It was also things like lawyers, real estate people, financial planners. All these people now were targeting the same-sex community, so there was an uptick in a little bit of a business.
Oh, there wasn't a little uptick. There was a very, very astute.
That's astute.
Made my business partner Jeff Coakley the day that the decision came down. We put out a daily paper that day with sponsorship by a couple of banks, and we immediately launched a wedding planner. We actually had a little booklet that came out the day of marriage, which made us an enormous amount of money that day with guiding people, and we had a section with wedding announcements.
Capitalizing.
We probably made, you know, $250,000 into the newspaper just from marriage alone. It's a billion-dollar industry, and he's right, not just about the wedding planners, but lawyers. And the first call we got when the decision came down was from a divorce lawyer. Swear to God, a divorce lawyer who wanted to place an ad about same-sex divorces.
And John, thank you for the call. I'm sorry.
But I also wanted to mention that, you know, you would think that other states that have this sort of a downturn in the economy would maybe kind of think of that way as having a consistent way of having an economic buildup in their state without sort of the ills that come along
well,
with it.
Well, yeah. Romney was afraid we were going to become the Las Vegas of gay marriage.
Didn't you say that?
Yeah,
he actually used those words.
No. See, gambling brings ills with it, but this always brings kind of good stuff.
So it comes down to, John, legalizing recreational marijuana or legalizing same-sex marriage to fill those coffers. John, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it. Shall we go to Mike in the car?
Mike in the car.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to share a reminiscence. I had come out as a gay man kind of in middle age about 10 years ago, and I remember I was actually on the hill in front of the Cambridge City Hall on this very day 10 years ago, and there was a huge group gathered in the late afternoon into the evening, and people just like spontaneously burst out in song. I remember we were all singing Going to the Chapel.
Yeah, right. That's funny.
And it just would stop. And it was just, it was so much fun. I can't even begin to tell you how energized I felt and how, you know, just how wonderful it was to be part of history. I didn't know I was even part of history, but it just was such a beautiful time and a great memory. I just wanted to share that with you all.
You can still hear the joy in Mike's voice, can't
you?
Even 10 years after.
We use the word historic all the time, and then when it actually happens, it's just, it's an amazing thing. You know,
we lost one caller, but the caption here said it's still okay to be opposed to it, isn't it? So I wanted to talk to him.
No,
but there are. I know. Well, actually, should we take Angel? He doesn't sound.
Yeah, actually, we should. Angel. We haven't spoken to you in ages.
Angel?
Yeah. Angel. We used to talk to him all the time on the Ultra. Angel from Walpole. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. How are you, Angel?
Hey, how you doing, Jim? Hi, Marjorie.
Well, Marjorie's not there,
Emily,
but I'll pass
right.
it along.
Oh, Marjorie's not there.
Where's Marjorie? What do you mean where she is? She's not here, Angel.
Jim?
What's that?
Did you get rid of Marjorie?
Angel, you're not going to hurt my feelings, are you, Angel?
Go ahead, Angel. Talk to Sue.
Well, Sue, listen, this is what I'm going to say, and it's a delicate subject. And let me see if I can articulate some good about this. I am in favor of a traditional marriage for the reason, and I'm going to use a game as an example, baseball. Baseball has been around for years, and they've always been, there's no rules, there's no changes to the game, and there's no approaches to the game, but it's always been called baseball. I am in favor of civil union, and I think that they should have all the rights that traditional marriage couples have. Let's say that you get married to a gay man in the Dominican Republic, you should be allowed to bring it over and through marriage, get his paper and everything. I mean, I'm in favor of that. The reason why I'm not in favor of being called marriage is because something else is already called marriage. So I don't know if I'm articulating good about
no,
that.
You
don't
did.
Go
no,
away.
No, 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 no.
Yeah,
right,
go
right,
away.
Right, Sue. No, that's great.
I think apple should be called apple and oranges should be called orange.
I actually don't disagree with you, except there's a couple of challenges. One, and you're an international guy, I know you know that there are two. Here in America, we have two marriages. For most people, but we weren't aware of it until recently. You know, in places like Germany, you go to the town hall and get your civil marriage license. And then if you want to have a religious ceremony, you have a religious marriage. But here in America, because when the frontiersmen went out to the West, the only person who could sign marriage certificates happened to be the minister, who was usually the only person who went out there. They didn't have a lot of government out there, which is why ministers are allowed to sign marriage licenses. So our government marriage and our religious marriage had become combined. So here in America, we call it all marriage. So if you would like to make a movement to turn all of our government marriages into civil unions and only call our religious marriages marriage, I'm all for that.
How about that, Angel?
But the tradition of marriage was already in place before the gay marriage.
But traditional marriage also used to have women as property to men. So are you okay with that?
Actually, Angel may be. I know Angel. Hey, Angel, we're really glad to hear from you again. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got
to
fade him out.
Angel, stay in touch. It's been a long time. Angel,
I'm an
from
expert
Walpole.
On Saxon marriage law because
yeah,
of all
good.
This, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Tomorrow is the 10th anniversary of the first same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, and we know what's happened since. 17 states plus D.C. in total. If you want to talk to Sue, me, or Emily, or just give us your 2 cents, 877-301-8970. I also remember talking to you in the past, Sue O'Connell, about how the only way we will ever get from here to there is if the Supreme Court of the United States ultimately says it's a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, how come
it is, but it is possible. I mean, there's got to be a change, obviously, in composition. I don't think this.
Yeah.
Well, you don't agree with that?
No, I actually think that. I mean, you know, remember, Massachusetts is the first state that was able to fight off a DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, statewide. We also have got this mix between a judicial decision and a lawmaker's decision. And I think that it will just naturally happen. I think it would happen quicker, but
naturally happen in the Supreme Court because what I was about to
naturally happen state by state.
Well, and by the way, I thought that was ridiculous when you said that to me 3 or 4 years ago. And it turns out you're being when you include the Arkansas's and the Idaho's and the whatever, it is conceivable. Maybe not 50. But it's conceivable by the time there's a more liberal Supreme Court.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's two analogies here for sort of objective fans of history. There's the expansion of the West during slave years, before the Civil War, when it became, you know, will the new states have the ability to have slaves or will they be anti-slave, and what happens to this free men and the slaves within that? And unfortunately, that ended in the Civil War, which fortunately ended up making free states for all. And there's also the freedom to choice issue, which the folks in Great Britain have done differently than we have done here in America. America, where there it went to ballot boxes, and it made it more of an inclusive feel, that people feel they were able to be included in the decision. I'm not saying we should have done that
here. No,
you're
not in favor of that.
No, but what I'm saying is that the feeling that the folks in Great Britain have about their freedom to choice is that they felt like they were involved in it. People in marriage no longer use the terms in against gay marriage, that it's being shoved down our throats, because there have been a variety of ways that we have come to this idea or agreement that people should be allowed to marry. And
okay,
I think the buy-in of the citizens is a very important part.
Even though, this is the last admission I'm going to make of how wrong I was in so much of this. I know I had this debate with Arlene Isaacson, mm-hmm. who was obviously one of the pioneers on this, but I thought I had it with you too. I was an outlier. While I was pro-gay marriage, my view was put the question on the ballot, because and a lot of the gay rights advocates mm-hmm. were screaming at me, that's insane, mm-hmm. it puts it at risk, it's a civil right that shouldn't be voted mm-hmm. on. My attitude, which was totally wrong, is Massachusetts is never going to accept it if it's a judicial mandate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The people need to embrace it. Well, as it turns out, I don't know what the polling numbers are intra-Massachusetts. Right. My guess is 70%, mm-hmm. 75%. I was totally and completely wrong.
But, you
wrong.
Had the constitutional conventions, which is what really aired it out a lot.
In
you know,
the legislature.
We had, like, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 of them, you know, that happened. And people made the arguments from the floor. I mean, I will never forget Senator Dianne Wilkerson's great moving speech about you know, when people were property and when people were not allowed to marry, you know, and she was obviously speaking about African Americans, but resonating. And those opportunities for the lawmakers who were elected, you know, we didn't have a vote, but we did elect our lawmakers, and the resounding wins of the pro-gay marriage candidates that happened after this. It really set in place for other states that you can be pro-gay marriage, you can be an activist, and go on to become the mayor of Boston, like Mayor Marty
Walsh.
You know,
so the one thing that everybody pointed to at the time, and I don't know if enough time mm-hmm. has passed, was the effects on children.
Yep.
Young children growing up in same-sex mm-hmm. households, and what effect that would have, and have, you know, even
like Tom
even
Riley,
sexual,
state yes, attorney general, yes. Tom Riley was.
Do we have any data
yeah.
on that?
I mean, the data that was being used at the time was also so poorly done and so damaged that every time it came up, we had to fight to show how all of those researchers had been discredited. I mean, generally what we find that our kids are no better or no worse than everybody else's kids. But there are studies that show that the kids of gay and lesbian parents who are parented by gays and lesbians turn out to be a little bit more self-aware, a little bit more socially aware of social justice issues, and tend to do better in some of the psychological profiling that they do. I mean, the hope is that it's not going to matter in the long run. And, you know, it's like the kids of mixed race or mixed religion marriages or single parent households in the old days. You know, the kids deal with it.
The other shoe on that mm-hmm. was that it would influence kids and make them think that this was an option, mm-hmm. that sexuality was an option.
Well, I mean, I think that we have shown over the years that there is growing research that whether you're gay or lesbian, your homosexuality is sort of set for you in the way that you were born. It has certainly made it more accepting. I think that there are more out gay kids in middle school and high school than there were, but I don't think there are any more.
Yeah, speaking of kids, one last thing about this before we go back to the calls. You and I were talking about yours, who I know pretty well, yours meaning Sue's. And we were talking about the fact, you know, Marjorie and I occasionally will have a conversation where one of our kids years ago saw a typewriter and said, "What's that?" And you say, because they never lived when there was a typewriter. Kids who are in their teens don't even know a time when there was not gay marriage, mm-hmm. at least in those jurisdictions where there is gay marriage, like Massachusetts, which is pretty incredible,
actually. It is. And I mean, I was at a fundraiser for President Obama at the BCA, Boston Center for the Arts, last year, and I had the choice between taking a picture of Ruby with President Obama or lobbying him for same-sex marriage. So, of course, like a really terrible parent, it came to my turn, and I said, "President Obama, we're waiting for you on same-sex marriage." And he said, "We're going to get there." And Ruby looked at me, and she said, "Really? Really? You couldn't take a picture. You had to try. Really?"
But I've seen a picture.
I got pictures of her, but it was hysterical. Like, she's like, "Is that the most important thing right now?"
Well, maybe it was. Marlon, you were in Boston. You're on with Sue O'Connell on Boston Public Radio. Marlon, thanks so much for your call. Hi.
Hi, guys. This is a hard phone call for me. I've been married for 9 years. It'll be in September. We were on the steps of Cambridge City Hall 10 years ago. my husband died suddenly about 2 weeks ago. And I just have to say, we had never really anticipated what that would mean to us to be legally married and for him to be my spouse when it came to all things that come along with the death of someone you love. Everything from, you know, spousal support rights to inheritance taxes and all those kinds of things. And we met with the probate attorney this week, and one of the things he said was, you are so lucky that you live in Massachusetts.
You know, what about my husband died 20 years ago. What about the the SSI benefit, which is a joke, but it's a Social Security insurance benefit. I think it's $247.
And I will
Did you get that too?
Yeah, because
Of the DOMA decision.
I mean, there are over 100 basic rights that are granted to couples as soon as they get married. And a lot of folks, you know, I remember seeing Andrew Sullivan, former editor of the New Republic in 1993, talking about how marriage was going to be the pathway to these rights. We are a nation that has built things around married couples. And when you can't get those rights, I mean, simple rights to remains, which is something you never think about. And I'm sorry you're thinking about this now, obviously. But, you know, during the AIDS crisis, we had couples who had been together for years and one of them died and the family would take the body and not let the spouse, for lack of a better term, have the right to bury or take care of the remains. And it's just, you know, these are just the things you automatically get on your wedding day when you sign that license.
Right.
And to be excluded from it excludes you from the mainstream.
Go ahead, Marlon. I'm sorry.
And for us, for me as his husband, to be able to write an obituary that didn't have to say longtime companion, partner, just those simple words of saying that we were married on the beaches of Provincetown and that my husband, he was survived by his husband, is something that every human being who falls in love needs to have.
Wow.
Marlon, that was a spectacular call. We're really glad
sorry
you shared
loss.
It with us. We are sorry,
Thank
Marlon.
You.
Thanks. You know, earlier someone hung up who the question, they spoke to one of our producers, and the question they were going to ask you, Sue, is it all right to oppose gay marriage in 2014? What's the answer?
Yeah, of course.
He's back, I think.
Yeah,
There's actually, can we go to, I don't know if it's the same guy or not, but that's his, can we go a little bit out of order here since I broached it? This is Joe from New Hampshire. Is he ready for us or no? Well, whether he is or not, Joe. But in any case, Joe's there. Joe, you're welcome to Boston Public Radio. That's your question, correct?
Yes, how are you?
We're
you
good,
doing,
thanks. Talk to Sue.
Sue, how are you?
Good, Joe.
I just want to say congratulations on the 10 years.
Thank you.
You know, it is very, very
I'm still unmarried, by the way, so if anyone out there wants to give me a ring,
go ahead, Joe.
Put a ring on it.
All right, so my question would be, and I want to know how you feel about this, what about the people who don't believe in gay marriage?
That, you know what?
They just believe it between a man and a woman. I almost feel like that people are almost afraid to say that they don't believe in gay marriage. Like, they just have to jump on the boat.
Right.
Because now it's almost like the tables are turned, and you may not be liked by so many people who are for gay marriage.
Yeah, I mean, I totally...
Well, I just want to know what your opinion is.
You're about to hear it, Joe.
I chime in on this, too.
I totally support everybody's right to have their own personal opinion about everything on the face of the earth. I mean, I have, during this entire period from 1992, fully supported religious people who are opposed to it for religious reasons. I don't even have to agree with their religious reasons. If that's your religion and that's what you believe, I totally support it. I support your right to say it. I support the right of the government not to come down on you for saying it and expressing it. But at the same time, you know, you can be against interracial marriage. You can be against interspecies.
The women's vote.
You can be against anything, but you can't allow the government to discriminate against people. And I know that it's people hold unpopular opinions all the time about a variety of things. And you sort of have to be aware of what society is telling you back about your opinion. But you're completely entitled to your right about anything.
That's a pretty fine answer there, Sue O'Connell. Yeah. Let's take one more quick one. Christine, you're in West Brookfield. You're on with Sue O'Connell, Emily Rooney, and me, Jim Browdy. Hi, Christine. Thanks for the call.
Hi. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I just wanted to make a comment. My wife and I got married in Massachusetts pretty much as soon as we could.
Congratulations.
And I just wanted to say how surprised I've been at what almost a non-issue it seems when I use the word wife.
Yep.
And often people see my ring and they'll say, oh, you know, they'll refer to my husband. And I'll say, no, my wife. And people don't seem at all surprised.
I have. It's funny you bring this up because I was hoping to be able to bring this up. I have friends who married, you know, 2 days after it was available, and they were buying furniture, and they had bought furniture from Jordan's Furniture, and they were on the phone, and whenever they were ordering a delivery, my friend Bonnie would say, "My wife will be home," and nothing, nothing.
Nobody said.
No one said anything, and it has been just completely. I mean, this is sort of the normalization of things, you know, and as our old friend said that he was against the term marriage, people know what marriage is.
Angel.
They know what marriage is. They know what it means. They know what your commitment is. They know what all of that is, that if you say, my wife will be home, they don't care if you're a woman or a man. They just know what that means. And
people are
comfortable. Exactly. And the more comfortable people are with using wife and husband, you know, it makes others more comfortable hearing it.
That's right.
I think it's really, we've come a really long way in terms of being accepted.
We did. I miss the old days in the 70s.
Thanks.
Remember, we had lovers.
I was going to say, people conflate this idea that they don't like something with trying to make it illegal.
And right.
To your point about having any opinion you want.
I mean, Emily,
you
don't like a lot of things.
That's
right. You can imagine if you were in charge, for instance, my gosh.
But it's got to be legal.
It is. I'll end where we started with you. It is amazing.
It is.
Emily thinks you're not that surprised by the progress in 10 years.
No, I think it's been slow.
I am flabbergasted.
I am too.
It is just
slow.
It's sort of like you can remember still being an adult when it started. You know, that's sort of the thing.
Yeah.
But if you want to hear the broadcast that I did for the old 1 in 10, it's up at baywindows.com, the night of Cambridge same-sex marriage beginning. So
great.
It's really, I mentioned Jim.
Do you mention that you hugged Jim Browdy?
In the first 10
okay,
minutes,
fine.
10 years ago, I mentioned
well,
Jim Browdy.
Hey, Sue, congratulations. Great, really glad to spend the day with you.
All
thanks
right.
so much.
Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Great to see you, too.
Thank you.
All right, up next, Callie Crossley joins us to go over big and small stories of the week. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH. Bye. Thank you.
This is what listener-supported radio sounds like.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to invite you into the conversation.
In fact, 7 out of every $10 spent on daily operations here at WGBH comes from listeners.
I'll tell you, I'm in a particularly good mood today, Marjorie.
I can't really handle it myself. 89.7 WGBH, your home for public radio.
Support for WGBH comes from you and Dover Rug and Home. Rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's spring event in Natick or at doverrug.com. And the Museum of Science, where you can see over 2,000 species of sea life, introducing Journey to the South Pacific, a new IMAX film that takes you to the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. More at mos.org/South Pacific.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is sitting in for Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Friday, is the host of Sunday Nights Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Hello there, Callie.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Callie. How are you?
I'm good.
So one of the things we're dying to get your opinion on is this thing that was editorialized in the Boston Globe today about three Boston City councilors voting present when asked to honor a resolution recognizing the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, which is, of course, the landmark ruling that desegregated schools. Why would they do that? Sal LaMattina, Bill Lenihan, I think maybe we can understand, and then Stephen Murphy. Why?
Yeah. Why do we understand?
Well, because he's, well...
Yes, go ahead. Okay. I don't understand.
You know what I mean.
I have to say.
Yeah.
So this was a simple, straightforward resolution like they do at city councils
all
over the country all
the
time. What's the issue?
Well, I'll tell you what the message was by their not voting is that the persistent image of Boston as a place that is not welcoming, not inclusive, and people keep saying, no, that's the old reputation of Boston. Well, here we are with three leaders of the city who don't have enough presence of mind to do anything but vote presence on a resolution that honors a fairly monumental piece of legislation. Let me just say, let me begin here. I wouldn't be sitting here without Brown versus Board of Education. That's how monumental it was. This was a sea change in all of America, not very directly impacting African Americans, of course. It was directed at schools. That was its purpose, its narrow purpose. But its broader one was that we desegregated eventually the United States and made an entire cultural, legal shift about how we live and how we support when we say everybody is free in America.
You know,
and they vote present.
They vote present. And part of the argument is at least one or two of them said, well, you know, it's one thing. Of course, we love Brown versus Board of Education, but we didn't want it, our vote, an affirmative vote, to be seen as an embrace of busing. I think
because
the Globe
editorial.
Because a lot
of people thought that didn't work.
Right.
Didn't have anything to do with Brown versus
exactly.
Board of Education.
But listen to this, by the way. Sal Lamatina suggested Charles Yancey, who was one of the people who filed this, knowing, I'm reading from David Bernstein's piece in Boston Magazine, knowing the contentiousness of the issue of busing in Boston, quote, set me up by calling for a roll call rather than a voice vote. In other words, set me up by saying I actually have to go on the record saying what my position is. Steve Murphy said much of the same thing, that Yancey unfairly, quote, sprang it on us. And then he goes on to say no one opposes Brown versus Board of Education. What is most troubling to me, I have to say, even though, as Emily suggested, it may be the most expected, the fact that the leader, the president of the Boston City Council, thought about this and chose, he said he didn't have enough time to read it, but as Bernstein, or some one of them, maybe the Globe makes the
319
point,
words.
Exactly. He could have read it in about 30 seconds. The fact that he voted present on this and is the leader, at least titularly,
but,
of the Boston City Council is
unbelievable.
But
did they not know, wasn't this on the agenda? What's the difference whether it was a roll call or a voice vote? It had to be on the agenda, no?
Of course it was on the agenda. This is ridiculous. I mean, you know, I mean, I am embarrassed and angry about this stupid vote by people who can't be bothered enough. If you don't know what the resolution is all about, ask a question.
Yeah.
You know, this is crazy.
How many people were city councilors in this room right now? I was. Well, I can tell you exactly what happened on the Cambridge. There was a ton of things that we hadn't read before.
Sure.
And when the issue came up, and there's an endless list, if you didn't know what it was, you said, can I have a minute?
Yeah.
So you either read the thing or you ask the sponsor in a public meeting, tell me about this. What are you trying to do? And then you're informed enough to be able to make a decision. So this is total. Yeah. And let me say one more thing, and this may be unfair, but I hope it's not. You know, Michelle Wu took a lot of heat for voting for Bill Linehan, a woman elected as a progressive. This is going to be really, in my opinion, tough for her come election time next time. It's one thing to have him be more conservative on some issues, is, you know, running away to Ireland for the St. Patrick's Day parade, that sort of thing. But to vote present on arguably one of the handful of most important Supreme Court decisions commemorations is
Well, Lamatina is saying that,
and to conflate it with busing.
Yeah, conflate it with busing. And he was saying, I didn't want to get into a debate about busing.
Who's debating
Why would
it?
There have been a debate?
Exactly. Nobody's debating it. And as I understand it, as I've been told, there's some animus toward Charles Yancey. You know, take it outside.
Yeah.
And by the way, Ayanna Pressley's name is on this.
Yeah.
You know, go ask her if you don't like him. What is your problem if you're representing? It really is embarrassing.
And good for Bernstein. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't even know about it until you alerted us to Bernstein's thing, Callie. But good for the Globe. Because it, you know, it's not the biggest substantive issue ever, but it is a huge symbolic issue for Boston. And again, it was their lead editorial today. Good for them. So from sublime, not to the ridiculous, but to the recreational. Marty Walsh once again lives up to a commitment. He said he was going to put together a late night task force to figure out what parts of Boston should stay open later. Obviously, this is in concert to a degree with the 24/7, but the late weekend service on the T, and he appointed a group fairly promptly that apparently has been meeting to decide what parts of the city should be open that are, you know, more populated by young people late at night. What's the task force doing? And there's a pilot this summer, I read, too. What's going on with this group?
Well, I just love this. And there are 24 of them, and there are all kinds of folks. You can go online and get the whole list of everybody. It's a pretty eclectic group. You know, some people pointed out, I guess, that there could have been even more diversity if you wanted to have more than one representative from a single Boston Neighborhood Association. And, you know, that, and there's nobody from the startup companies, which it probably would have made sense. On the other hand, we have this guy I never heard of before. Maybe you knew him, Kareem Aga. He says he runs a business by day, but he's a food critic by night. Loving it. You know,
I mean,
this is a guy to be on a task force about late night stuff. And there's two students on there. Hello. They like to be out late. So, and apparently in these two meetings that they've already had, there've been vigorous discussions. So everybody's not rolling over with the same idea of what late night should look like, which I enjoy as well. There should be a lot of discussion about what that means. And it doesn't always just, it doesn't come down to just leave the bars open. It means other activities that could be open.
But so, why discriminate? Why not just, if they make a ruling about how late places can stay open, why can't it be all of them? Are we afraid that there's going to be...
Well, it may be a financial issue right away.
Well, there's also a public safety issue. I mean, one of the things that's raised in the piece that we were reading this morning is a concern of more than a few is obviously public safety has got to follow late night openings. Just like public safety, we had this discussion with Beverly Scott, who's the head of the T, and Rich Davey, our boss, Secretary of Transportation. Obviously, you need cops and other kinds of things to ensure people are safe late at night in neighborhoods where they otherwise wouldn't be. So I assume that's an issue. And I like the notion of picking a neighborhood based upon research, or two or three. They actually say the pilot may be citywide. I'd like to see it in a couple of neighborhoods, see how the city handles it, see how the people of the city and those who come into it use it. And then if it's working well, then expand it to the whole city. I mean, the notion that this city, which is a world-class city, essentially shuts down almost when the sun goes down, it's preposterous.
It is preposterous.
And not only for the people who live here, but if you want to attract all these conventions and make all this dough from tourists, you got to stay open
at
night.
That's embarrassing. It's a list of embarrassments.
Well, I can say that. And I will, just one point to you to support what you're saying. They got the Harvard Kennedy School looking at data. So they're, you know, looking very carefully. It's not just, I think this neighborhood is open later or should have something. They're, you know, starting with some documents. So I think that some documentation, I think that's very important. And I'll just say, my sorority is meeting here in August. The whole eastern region of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority is meeting here. You know, they'd like to be out at 3:30. Tell me,
are
some ladies that can party.
Still?
Of course. Hey.
Wow.
We do our public service, but we're hip and
even the hotels don't stay open late. I tell that story about after the World Series. I couldn't get a hamburger. I was walking home at 1:30 in the morning.
Is this true?
I was starving because I'd stayed at the game, you know, because I was getting video for the next day. Thousands of people pouring out of Fenway Park. I couldn't have been the only one hungry.
No.
Could not. I went to like 10 different places. Could not get anything.
This is why the food trucks, I'm just thrilled about them at least being out there till 1. But, you know, let's have some energy. We all use New York as an example. I know it's not quite fair. But, you know, at any hour, something's going on that could be interesting. And we can do the same thing here.
Since you brought that up, let me speak to that for a second. When people say, why'd you love living in New York? And I lived there for 15 years. One of the reasons I loved it is because it was open all the time. And people say, well, what did you do late at night? And the answer in most cases was nothing. I lived a few blocks, one of my many illegal rent-controlled apartments. I lived a block away from the Empire Diner, which sadly has closed. It was open 24/7. I'd go there maybe once every couple of months. But the fact that you knew your
security.
City was alive and awake.
You want some Thai food?
It was great.
Exactly.
Right, it was there if you wanted it, whether it was the cheeseburger after the World Series, whatever it was. It really changes the feel about a city, and I think only in a positive way. And good for Walsh for jumping on this thing. Right
and he
away.
Said he would do it. He's followed through with a lot of his stuff.
Yeah, that is impressive.
Now, I want you to know, though, that even if this pilot is in neighborhoods where your sorority sisters want it to be, you know where they will not be able to go if they stay up all night? Charlie's Sandwich Shop.
This is very sad.
For those who don't know, food, wine is sort of your avocation, for lack of a better.
That's right.
So how'd you feel when you read about Charlie's closed next month?
Went right through me, you know. And again, this is not a place I hang out all the time. No. But let me just say, this is a place they know how to do eggs over easy. They can't be too hard. They can't be too soft. And they know how to get it on the plate fast. You're cheek by jowl with all kinds of characters in there, which I personally enjoy. But you know what? You don't want to talk to them. They don't talk to you because, as many people know, sometimes out in the public, I'm not talking. I'm eating and reading. So this is just a wonderful thing.
Excuse me.
And the hot chocolate there is delicious. Even without the whipped cream, I must say.
Well, also, what they're most famous for, I have to say, I had never had anywhere else in the world before. I'm a corned beef hash. If they said you only have one food the rest of your life, greasy corned beef hash. I'm sorry, but it'd
That's
be my
disturbing.
Choice. But I never had turkey hash.
Yes.
And I resisted when I went there the first time.
Yeah.
It is, and that's their. By the way, that's their
signature dish.
The signature dish. Mm-hmm. It is spectacular. Did you ever have it?
I never have had that. I'll have to try that.
Have it better. Have it soon.
Callie,
I know
the family is not really upset about this. I mean, this has been a good run. It's been there since 1927. The building is very valuable. It's right there on Columbus Avenue. I mean, it's like...
He said he doesn't want to be carried. He's in his 70s. Yeah. He doesn't, one of the siblings, he doesn't want to be carried out of the place.
Yeah. I really get that, too. You know, but what you hate to lose are those places that have so much character.
I know.
Totally. Absolutely.
I'm going to be walking by there tonight. I'm going to go to a different restaurant.
We'll have a little turkey hash. Hey, on this last thing, before we find out what you're doing Sunday night, what's the food place? I will, the word eatery will never cross my lips. Okay. Oops, it just did. What's the food place that's closed in recent years that you miss the most?
Well, this was closed years ago, but I still have fond memories of it, and I can't think of the name of it. It was in Harvard Square and made the muffins. You could get the tops or the bottoms. What was the name of that, Jim?
Oh, my
It was
God.
Right in Harvard Square. It had a big old mug of coffee. It was delicious.
Not that German place.
Not that one.
No,
it was
another place. You say that, because when I moved to Cambridge in the 80s, one of the things I was most excited about, I first moved to Central Square, is there was a donut store in Central Square that had the best muffins I've ever had in my life. And I said, I can't believe I'm this close. It closed the next week after being open like 50 years. I still feel bad about it, by the way. And it's decades later.
Well, that
later.
Muffin Top restaurant was pretty darn good.
Can you do a little research and next week let us know what it is?
I would love to know what it is.
So maybe somebody will call in
and
send us an email.
What are you doing? Yep, do. If you know the, that's right. If you know the muffin joint in Harvard Square, email us.
With the tops.
What are you doing on Sunday night?
Well, speaking of Mayor Marty Welsh, one of the other things that he promised to pay attention to were these eyesores in various neighborhoods. This pieces of property and sometimes just, you know, pieces of land that have just been sitting in the middle of otherwise great streets that are horrible. People haven't paid taxes or whatever the issue is. So one in Dorchester, finally going through the program. We're using city money to renovate it. It's a single family. You know how valuable single family homes are on this lovely street? They can't charge any more than $283,000, which is, you know, in Boston, a wonderful thing. And it's a lottery. And this place was closed for 10 years.
Is it taking it by eminent domain? I mean,
I mean, beyond 10 years, I'm sorry. Decades and decades sitting there in a horrible, messing up the whole neighborhood. So there's that. So we're talking about that program. And on the back end of the show, we're looking at two headline events, the Michael Sam draft and the Donald Sterling rants with pop culture folks looking at sports influence and whether it's, you know, behind in making a cultural show or not.
You want my two cents?
Yes.
If Michael Sam makes the team, it changes the world.
Well, he made the... Well, you know.
Well, he asked if he is good enough to stay with the team. She's frowning at me.
Yeah. I just hated the whole staging of that thing. The whole thing's
huge.
Well, you thought it was staging that he didn't get it.
Well, he's now got a reality show. And so the fear is that was all part of a scene
the
for the reality
and
show.
And
no,
Oprah's
on top of that all the time.
I was put off.
We'll be listening Sunday night. Kelly, good to see you. Thank you.
All right, Kelly.
All right. All right.
Under the Radar. You can catch her Sunday night at 6. Thank you. Up next, tunes from the crypt. It's kind of disturbing, too. Michael Jackson's posthumous album, Escape. I'm not going to even say that right. Emmett Price and Edgar Escape is out. Emmett Price, Edgar B. Herwick III join us next for their reviews. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston.
Today at WGBHnews.org, a harbor view for middle-class folks is part of John Barrows' new development plan for Boston. If you missed it on the radio, catch the story at WGBHnews.org right now.
Food, entertainment, jobs, increasing choices could be overwhelming our ability to make smarter decisions. I'm Kara Miller, this week on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and HBX, the online learning initiative powered by Harvard Business School faculty for college sophomores, juniors, and seniors who want to learn the language of business. Accepting applications for June at hbx.hbs.edu. And the communities of Orchard Cove and Newbridge on the Charles, offering you the information you and your parents need to make the right decision about senior living. You can check out the guide at hslindependentliving.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Emily Rooney. And I should say, Emily said, if you know the name of the restaurant that Kelly's talking about in Harvard Square, please email in. Well, in a nanosecond, we learned it was the Pewter Pot, and thank you to whomever did that. So some people, I guess you could say in paranormal circles, say the dead can talk, but can they sing and release albums? It turns out the answer is yes. Michael Jackson's posthumous album, his second one actually, Escape, was released this week. Here with us in Studio 3 for their reviews are Edgar B. Herrick III. We're going to play a lot of music. Don't worry. The man behind GBH's Curiosity Desk and Emmett Price. Usually hear him on Mondays here. He's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Towards Bridging the Generational Divide. Hello, gentlemen. And by the way, we are opening the lines.
Yes.
If you want to talk about the music, if you've heard it or hear it in a minute, if you're creeped out by the fact that it's yet another posthumous album from one of the greatest performers in the history of the world, you can tell us that too at 877-301-8970.
All right. So I don't even know. I haven't heard a word of this.
I've heard all of
Emmett.
You haven't heard any of it.
Nope.
And you're somebody who likes Justin Timberlake, right?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
So, you know, the sort of lead single out of this, which was debuted at an event earlier this month, I guess May 1st was when it was first unveiled. There's a version that the lead single where it's one of those Justin Timberlake is singing with the dead Michael Jackson and it's all seamed together. Yes, Love Never Felt So Good. That's the name of the track.
I mean, kind of one of those Natalie Cole, you know, and her father, you know, Nat King Cole. Because, I mean, the track was actually recorded. The original was recorded in 1983. Justin Timberlake was 2 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, the spirit of, you know, someone singing with his mentor and really bringing this thing to life, I think it's a great track.
Yeah, we should be clear here. We we're assuming people know more.
They don't know.
These are tracks that Michael Jackson actually did between, I think, 83 and 99 that have never been...
I think even later than that. 2000 something. I think the Escape comes from the early 2000s.
Okay, the concept here is Antonio L.A. Reid, a phenomenal producer and part of the team of L.A. Reid and Babyface, who've written for everybody just about, comes up with this concept to it's about the 5-year anniversary of Michael's death, and he wants to go into the archives and find all of those tracks that were not released previously.
No.
And so he creates a filter, though. He says, you know, having worked with Michael before, he wants only songs that Michael recorded numerous times, you know, maybe, you know, 10 or 12 or 25 times, because he doesn't want to release things that Michael didn't really like. And Michael was a voracious, I mean, you know, he was in the studio and he worked. So he wanted these songs. So they came up with 8 tracks.
The other thing they did, which I think is important to say, is not only songs that Michael had recorded multiple times, but one of their other criteria is that they contain Jackson's vocals from top to bottom, which means they're full takes, right? So, the things that Michael had recorded, it's worth saying, were still, even when recorded multiple times, were in demo form, ostensibly, right? They weren't finished and polished.
Yeah, that fact alone, isn't that a little bit disturbing, because he didn't get to finish the product.
I totally agree, and we should talk about that a little bit, because that's one of the pitfalls of any kind of reclamation project like this, right?
Yeah.
Where Michael Jackson isn't part of the process. And I think it's worth mentioning, and we'll listen to some music in a minute. I think it is really worth mentioning that, because in the case of Michael Jackson in particular, he was very active in the studio, in the production process. If you look at his greatest work, Off the Wall, Thriller, Bad, he's a co-producer with Quincy Jones on every one of those albums, which means that Michael had an active role in this. And, you know, you think about, I think about the song, the song Billie Jean, which is probably his most popular song ever, right? And the story behind that song is incredible. It's incredible. Michael's fighting for his vision of it. Him and Quincy Jones got into it over that song. First of all, Quincy Jones didn't want to put it on the album. Michael brought him a demo, and Quincy Jones was like, I don't really like the bass line. I don't really like this. Michael said, no, it works. Then they had this huge argument over the intro to that song.
Who was against that? Yeah. It's one of the greatest songs ever.
So Quincy Jones said, it's too long, Michael. It's got to go. It's like 40 seconds. We can't do it. Michael said, no. And this is the term he used. He said, but Quincy, that's where the jelly is.
And
Michael says the jelly is the thing that makes him want to dance.
Yeah.
And so when he sort of said it that way, Quincy said, well, who am I going to be to tell Michael Jackson to take the thing out that makes you want to dance?
Yeah,
he also made the bass guitarist, just by the way,
go ahead.
He made the bass guitarist bring every single one of his guitars into the studio and play them for him until Michael decided which bass guitar was going to be the right guitar.
Wow.
They also mixed the song 91 different times.
Now here's the hit. I mean, here's, I mean, you have somebody who's very hands-on and heavy-handed on the whole recording process, let alone the mastering process and the release process. So the irony is that this song, Love Never Felt Like This, the song that we'll play shortly, would have been on that album. It would have been on that
album.
That's
true.
That's my concern. I have to say, era. I listened to all eight of these songs this morning. Not the on the deluxe version, you get the original demo, plus the contemporized, for lack of a better expression. I read that word 12 times this morning. And so I'm using it myself.
It's trending on
version,
Twitter.
But it seems to me, Em, at first, that if you really love the guy, like almost everybody did and does, is he wasn't happy enough, no matter how many times he did these tracks, to release them. So if he wasn't happy enough, why should we
be so okay with the notion that
an artist of this magnitude we get to hear when he didn't want us to hear it yet?
I can go with that, Jim, except for the fact, remember in 83, we were still doing concept albums. So it wasn't necessarily that he didn't like the track. The track didn't fit in the concept that he was putting together for the Thriller album. So, and here's the other catch. You have the producers who were working with Michael at the time, who were able to come back 15, 20 X amount of years later and actually, you know, try to finish the product in the spirit of Michael being there.
I think we're driving people crazy. They want to hear this.
Yeah, I was going to say, now that we've teased it out,
let's listen to that
track that we've been talking about. This is, you know, in my estimation, the best, by far the best song on this album. Here's a little bit of that track.
Dance.
You hear Justin there.
Let me see you move.
You know, in the words of Chris Matthews, I get a thrill up my leg. It is as creepy as it is, and as conflicted as I am about the issue we just discussed. That is one great song.
It's a great piece. I mean, it has the spirit of Michael. It has the energy of Michael. You want to just move to it. And then what perfect timing to release that for summer. I mean, this is going to be the hit that we're going to hear all summer long. And I guarantee you it'll be nominated for a Grammy.
So, but here's the interesting thing. And Jim, I'm like you. I'm very conflicted about this. And I think that this track works a lot better than many of the other tracks on this album. In part because
they're not all mixed with other artists.
Oh. But this is the one for all of the contemporizing
that I think sounds the least contemporized, right?
And it's funny because I know that Timbaland and some of the people who were involved in this project talked about, you know, wanting to contemporize these because they're imagining, I want to hear this on the radio. How's it going to stand up against a Katy Perry song or whatever? And the truth of the matter is that this is one that, once again, something that Michael was good at throughout his career, which is capturing a moment in time or whatever. That idea of this disco-flavored sound just happens to be back in a little bit, right? Yeah. There's a little bit of an appetite for it. And because of that, you're able to take something and actually present it much like, this is the one that sounds most like what it would have sounded like, I think, in 82 or 83 if it was released then. And they're being more true to the spirit of the time of this track, and in part, that's why I think it works.
This being the biggest hit.
Well, I mean, this track
you don't
is
think
timeless. It's going to be a hit, I guarantee you. But there are some sleepers on this album. There are some sleepers. There's a song called "Slave to the Rhythm," which is classic Michael in this kind of danceable beat. And let's try this theory out. I think we have both versions. Let's play, you know, just a few seconds of the original.
Meaning the one that Jackson did himself.
Which had been 1991. This was written by L.A. and Babyface in 1991. And it would have been on the Dangerous album. Mm. You know, the album that had Black or White and Remember the Time or Heal the World. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to the original clip just for a second.
So, Emmett, is that how it was ready to go? Had it gone on the album, would have gone like that?
They would have touched it up just a little bit. They would have polished it. They would have cleaned it up. But this was the raw kind of, you know, pre-mastered, you know, version of it. And, you know, Michael said no for whatever reason. Now let's juxtapose that to this newly finished, remastered, you know, version of the same song.
Slave
All right, I vote for the original.
So I almost in
I kind of like the second one.
Do you? Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
me too, Emily. Me
yeah,
too.
There you go.
You're a 21st century gal. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
For me, almost invariably through this entire album, and I've listened through it a couple times, the full deluxe version, I almost always like the original demos a little bit better. And I get why you can't release. Yeah. They sound like demos, right? They sound like demos. But I think his vocals sound a little bit cleaner in those. They match up better.
I wonder if this isn't going to be a generational thing, too.
Exactly.
Though.
And right. Here's the piece. Here's
I think that's
the piece.
Probably part of the point.
Because Edgar and I are from the same generation. Well, you know. Go ahead, Emmett.
The newly remastered piece brings in some new synth. You have some hip-hop stuff, some DJ, kind of scratching in the back. And what it allows is to introduce this icon to a new generation who really wants to be a part of this whole appeal, but they were too young for it.
Yeah, but
so now they come in.
But does it need to be contemporized for them to like it, right? Like, if you look at what Johnny Cash Records did shortly after he died in subsequent years, I mean, it's a different audience, but, like, they went through the roof. And, people like the Beatles and
That's
Elvis
true.
Continue to sell Stones. Records.
Which
so
is,
the idea that you need to update Michael Jackson's catalog
you
somehow.
You can say contemporized.
And, quote-unquote, contemporize it. I think in some way, I don't think it necessarily needs that. And I think even if you look back at it, like all great artists, he had a great period. And I think my suspicion is that people still know tracks from Off the Wall and from Thriller.
Well, two things at play here. One, in the last probably 15 to 20 years, the role of the producer has risen.
That's true.
So you have the top producers in popular music now who have their hands in the cookie jar, working on the magic sauce, And the other piece is that now you have both versions released on this deluxe album. So you can, if you have this nostalgic piece, you can only listen to the old version.
Sure.
But if you like the new stuff with all the hip and the pop and the zip and the zoop and all that stuff on it, you can listen to the new version.
That's the voice of Emmett Price and Edgar B. Herwick III, and Emily Rooney is sitting in for Marjorie Egan. I'm sorry, Emily. Go ahead.
No, I was just wondering how this happened, given the state of Michael Jackson's estate. I mean, did they all have to pass off on this? How did it get to this point? And who's going to make the money off of it?
Well, I mean, the estate is going to make the money, and there have been some issues with the family and whatnot, but the estate is in place, right? The question of terms of, trusteeship and the ownership of the estate.
Who had to sign off on it?
Well, I mean, there's the trustees of the estate all signed. I mean, let's look at it this way. There has been, since 2011, the Michael Jackson Immortal World Tour, which has touched 3 million plus people, and right now it's the ninth top grossing tour of all time by Billboard magazine. And it's being traveled by the Cirque du Soleil, right, the kind of circus group and whatnot. So his music has been going around for years, and this is an opportunity to kind of build onto that. The estate is going to make Bukumula.
Okay, so let's step back from it a second before we do the next song. And I love this album, by the way. Not every song was great, but I thought it was a thousand times better. I was ready for the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Overall, Emmett Price, starting with you and then Edgar, how would you rate this thing?
I think it's strong. I don't think it's top. I don't think it's the best, album that will come out this summer. I don't think it's, Michael's best material. But it certainly allows us to heal from that 2010 album, Michael, which was absolutely horrific.
How about it, Edgar?
I'm going to make an analogy here, Jim, that will appeal to your Philadelphia roots.
Okay, go ahead.
I feel like this album is a lot like Rocky Balboa, the sixth Rocky movie.
Now, that is horrible.
No, and I'll tell you, no, it's not horrible, and I'll tell you why. Because the absolute unequivocally worst Rocky movie that came out was Rocky V. It was so bad.
Agreed.
It was so egregious, right? And that's what that first posthumous release, was like.
Yeah. Agreed.
Then Rocky Balboa came out, which was not a great movie. It was arguably not even a good movie, but it was so much better than Rocky V.
It's a low threshold.
It sort of cleaned the bad taste out of your mouth. And I think that's what this does. I think this is a middle of the road record. I think this is one really strong track and a handful of other tracks that are okay. And I think that if you're a music lover and you're a real Michael lover, I think the real fun in this is the digging back into the versions that are more like just his demos. If you like him a lot, I think that you're going to get more satisfaction. I feel like you will get more satisfaction combing through them and hearing some of the process and hearing Michael more in his moments through time than in hearing the updated contemporized
versions.
I think
it's more like Star Trek 11 myself. Now,
is there another two?
Let me just mention one. I don't know if we have sound from this. The one that was most shocking to me is there was a song ages ago called A Horse with No Name.
Yes.
It was a song that was number one. Mm-hmm. It was done by Group America. When the song came out, and Michael Jackson was 14 at the time when it came out, everybody, because no one had ever heard of America, thought it was Neil Young. And Neil Young has many incarnations in many bands. Yep. The lead singer sounds a lot like one of the greatest writers and performers of all time, Neil Young. That's my little editorial comment. And so decades later, Michael Jackson redoes the song, calls it A Place with No Name, just with the same exact tune, and just changes the words. Totally. What did you think of that thing, Edgar?
I think there's two things. I think it's cool.
Go ahead.
No. I mean, as a song, I don't think the song is great by any stretch of the imagination. I think the updated version's neat because you don't quite hear it as clearly. When you hear the demo version, it's done with an acoustic guitar being strummed to that famous two-chord drone. Ding, ding, ding. But to me, the fascinating part of that is it also shines a window on Michael Jackson and what an omnivore as a musical lover he was.
Yeah,
because
that's a good
he's
point.
A person that I think people categorize in a certain way, like dance music or whatever. He had his disco era, he had his Motown era, he had his disco era, then he had his kind of let's transform pop era. But I think Michael Jackson is a person, when you learn about him and read about him and understand what he thought about music, he listened to everything.
But he never did anything like this. He never did anything before where he took a song and not only did a cover of sorts, but a cover,
like a
rewriting the words. Yeah. I mean, no one's ever done. He hasn't done that. Did he ever do that?
No, he didn't
do
that.
Do we have a clip of that?
I don't know if we have that one.
Well, pick whatever you want, because we should hear more music. And by the way, if you want to participate in this discussion, 877-301-8970. If you've heard it and want to do a review, if you haven't heard it and want to talk to these guys or want to weigh in on the whole issue of the appropriateness of releasing such a thing with a guy without the guy signing off the artist himself, play something else for us, Emmett.
There's another sleeper on this album. It's called Escape. It's the title track. Now, this was, and Edgar mentioned it earlier, this was a song that he started with Rodney Jerkins, one of the phenomenal producers who's worked with just about everybody, Lady Gaga, Mariah Carey, J-Lo, Whitney Houston, Toni Braxton, Britney Spears. And they started this piece in 1999, and they didn't finish it until 2001. I mean, so it shows how of a perfectionist Michael was. And so let's listen to the original clip from, you know, circa 1999 to 2001 here. Of Escape.
No matter where I am, I see my face around. They've been lies on my name and put them down to town. Don't have a place to run, but there's no need to hide. I got to find a place, but I won't hide away. Escape.
Now, if you're a Michael Jackson fan, you would have known that this was around the time that the album Invincible came out, which was his first full-length album in about 6 years. And on that album, you would have had songs like You Rock My World, Cry, Butterflies. So let's listen to the remastered, updated version with Rodney Jerkins going back and working on the tapes that he had worked with Michael Jackson. Oh, this is a sleeper.
I like this one. And I like the contemporized version.
So do I.
All right, you're
I still like the older version.
Edgar. I'm getting them.
This one contemporizes pretty well. I still like the original version a little bit better.
This is going to be a club jam. It's going to be playing all over the country, all over the world. This is going to be a headbanger, as we call them. And you watch.
I love it.
877-301-8970 if you want to weigh in on a couple of... I have to say, the more I hear it, the more I like it. And I'm also trying to think, to put it in some historical context, with the exception of the thing you mentioned, which was weird but great.
Can I just say...
Natalie Cole... Oh, go ahead.
Every time that's brought up, I can't help but think of this...
Wait, we don't know what you're talking about.
Natalie Cole.
So Nat King Cole, who's, you know, did Unforgettable.
Yeah.
And then in, I guess it was the 90s, early 90s or whatever, Natalie Cole, his daughter, released a version
where
they spliced his dead voice with her voice singing a version of Unforgettable.
Fabulous. Yes. Even though it was the weirdest thing ever.
So at the time, Saturday Night Live does a sketch which was called Unforgivable. Natalie Cole sings with all her dad's dead old friends. And it is one of the funniest. You have Chris Farley as Mama Cass Elliot. You have Mike Myers as Ethel Merman. And then they do a bit where one person, they're like, and she sings with Tammy Wynette. And then Tammy Wynette comes and goes, hey, I'm not dead.
Well, you know, it's, I said to Edgar this morning, Emmett, that the only I love the first song, Love Never Felt So Good, the thing we talked about with Justin Timberlake. The only part I don't like, and this is really nitpicking, there's a point, and by the way, for those who haven't seen the video yet, it goes back and forth from dancers, Jackson, Timberlake, and Timberlake's pretty great in this thing, I should say. But there's a point at which Timberlake says something like, "Take it, Michael."
Yeah.
And I don't like that. No. I mean, I know that's it. A small thing. No. But I almost thought it was disrespectful. I know it sounds really anal on my part. It's sort of like, do your piece and let him do his piece.
On this song, I actually liked the version with just Michael. You know, I mean, you know, because, I mean, there was always some controversy around Justin Timberlake and Michael anyway. Because remember that Super Bowl issue with Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson where he ripped the clothes off of her. And all the ridicule went to her.
That's true.
Yeah,
and
that's
nobody talked about
that's
him at all.
Point.
So
then,
I actually liked the MJ version by himself.
I think that though, to be fair, you know, there is a history in Michael Jackson doing duets with people where they do talk to each other, right? Where they kind of there's the girl
we'll
is mine,
the worst ever.
The girl
the thing
is
with
mine
Paul
with
McCartney,
Paul McCartney, which is
unlistable.
Literally one of the worst things ever committed to whatever you committed to. But it's terrible. But they do talk to each other, you know, where they're arguing. The girl's mine. No, Michael, she's mine. And Michael's, come on, Paul, she's mine.
Even for that day, that was cheesy.
Oh my God, it's terrible. the thing is, Michael Jackson is one of these artists who, you know, at sometimes can be ultimate and genius, and other times can be kind of cheesy. I mean, he does run the gamut in his catalog.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Take It Michael thing.
So how much more is that? First of all, I hope you have at least one more additional thing to play for us. Do we? I don't know if we do or not. We'll find out in a second. But is there enough more in vaults that we're going to hear a third? And I'm finally warming up to the notion.
I think the fact that there are only 9 songs sort of indicates that there's probably more.
There's more, you know, and I hope that they call it here. You know, we look at, on the hip-hop side, you know, Tupac, Amaro Shakur, the great Tupac, after he passed away and was murdered, there were albums that came out, and we saw that although the first, you know, one or two kind of made a big splash, they kind of took a downturn. I mean, you know, the moment is kind of here. I'm hoping that it's going to stop here. I think they did a pretty good job of what they had. I know there's tons of material. I mean, Michael was always in the studio, so there's tons of stuff there, but I hope they call it here.
Yeah, they won't.
No,
by the way,
if it makes
terms
money,
of keeping
they won't.
People alive in a different sort of way. There's a Broadway show that's about to open in previews on June 2nd,
which is Tupac's
music, obviously. And there's a play that goes.
He's been gone a long time.
He has.
Okay, so even though we don't have anything more, we're going to play one more thing, one additional time, because I can't get enough of this. So can we end where we started? Love Never Felt So Good. This is the Justin Timberlake.
Thing we didn't mention about this, and I think you know the answer to this, Jim. Do you know who has a songwriting credit on this song?
I was so speechless. Does anybody know besides Edgar and me who has the songwriting? You
do. Not to our friends in Canada.
Okay, I'll give you a hint. Having My Baby. Does that give you a hint, Emily Rooney? Paul Anka.
Has
a writing credit
on
Love Never Felt So Good from the 60s. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. And this song, I think, had been recorded by other artists, not sounding like this.
Johnny Mathis.
That's it.
Johnny Mathis
right.
Recorded this.
And since we're into history, Emmett and Edgar, I'll do this for you. What famous theme song for a television show did Paul Anka write? Does anybody know here?
Oh, I actually don't know that
one.
You're stumping me on that.
Song. I can't think of
Tonight Show, a theme song for Johnny Carson, actually was written by Paul Anka.
No kidding.
No kidding, exactly. Right. Let's hear a little more of Love Never Felt So Good. This is the Timberlake-Jackson collaboration. It's not really. They're both on this thing. Let's hear it one more time.
Let me see you move. See you.
This is the one song, it gets stuck in your head, and it's really hard. Yeah. It's hard not to move your body to this song, which is, that's classic Michael Jackson is to do that.
True. I'm with you, Emma. Number one. It is terrific. I love that. I love the album. And despite all my reservations, I've swallowed them all in the last 25 minutes. It's great. Go get it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Great
Edgar
to see you both.
Edgar B. Herwick III, man behind GBH's Curiosity Desk. Emmett Price, professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Great to have you guys here.
Thanks, Emily.
Next, my catalog of obsessions and observations, also known as Emily's List. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And I doubt if it was ever mine. Not like you hold me. Hold me. Ooh, baby. Love never felt so good. All this month, the WGBH Spring Auction is your chance to bid on vacations, the latest electronics, fine dining experiences, rare collectibles, and even a brand new Toyota Avalon Hybrid XLE Premium, courtesy of your New England Toyota dealer. And every winning bid supports the news you trust and the programs you love. Special thanks to Rhodes Scholar, this year's premier sponsor. Place your bids online at auction.wgbh.org.
Support for our programs comes from you. And Boston 2034, a day-long event on June 10th showcasing ideas, innovators, and companies poised to drive the exponential economy in the years ahead. More at xconomy.com/Boston2034. And the 2014 Lincoln MKZ with standard Lincoln Drive Control, offering normal, comfort, and sport driving modes. Details about the MKZ and its features are available at lincoln.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Emily Rooney is sitting in for Marjorie Egan, who will be back on Monday. Emily, what time is it? It's the moment we've all been waiting for. Here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
You know, a couple of Fridays ago, Emily was sitting in for Marjorie, and for a variety of reasons we don't need to get into, we decided not to do Emily's List. And I have to say,
did we have protests?
We were flooded with emails saying, I actually wrote all the emails, and it was thoroughly depressing. We had a confab this morning. We decided just because Emily is not a guest today does not mean
absolutely.
She can't do the list.
I've been working on it.
So the way it starts every week, in addition to your little theme song, is I get to say to Emily, is there a theme to this week's list, Emily?
There is indeed a theme.
Fine. Take it away, Emily.
All right. So remember a few weeks ago, my list was true confessions, things like I throw my banana peels in other people's wastebaskets, that kind of thing. Well, today my list is a little heavier than that.
Oh.
It's things I wish were true, but just aren't.
Oh.
Things like, I wish this were true. Money doesn't buy happiness. Of course it does. What are you talking about?
Oh, you wish it were true that money didn't buy. Oh, I got it now. Yeah. It does. Yeah, it buys a significant piece of it. Not necessarily the whole yards.
You know, if you have money, you know, my father used to say something kind of funny. He'd say, there's nothing character building about being poor. Mm. You know, having nothing, not being able to go get a cup of coffee, a new shirt if you want it. And it's hard. I mean, I do think about that. I mean, I'm fine now, but there were times when I was making $68 a week once.
Doing what?
And working at a radio station.
Is that really true?
$68 a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is the whole list going to be depressing like this or not?
Okay, things I wish were true.
Were true but are not. Okay, go ahead.
This is not true. True love never dies.
Oh.
It does.
Of course it does.
I guess.
It becomes untrue. Yeah. It was true and then it's untrue.
Yeah. I mean, why do people say things like that when it's true?
Because it actually is a beautiful thing to say. Even though it is, there are a lot of things that
it's
are not.
It's just not true.
Okay, so what's the heading again of this thing?
Things I wish were true, but not. But they're not.
True love lasts forever. Okay, go ahead.
Uh-oh. It's better to give than to receive. That's not true.
No, of course it's not. Even though there is a piece of giving, would you know that there's a small
piece? No, it's very satisfying.
It is, for a second.
Yeah.
But then receiving lasts forever. Yeah. It's like, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it depends on what the gift is,
fine,
of course.
Okay, good.
All right, here's another thing.
Yeah.
I wish this were true. Nothing lasts forever. Well, you know, Yeah, death does.
That's true. Nuclear waste lasts forever.
Forever. Yeah. Death lasts forever. Yeah. Death in particular.
Can I rarely ask you, but this is occurring to me, how you come up with the theme, not the content. Yeah. The content, I know, just your inner creativity. How did you decide on this particular thing?
I think about
thing?
This kind of stuff all the time. So
you
it's
do.
Like, I
comes
do.
It comes naturally.
It does. So I start, and I start. So I, like right now, I have like 20 different lists going, and some of them are rather disturbing. And then when I think of something to add to it, you know, all right, here's one. You know when you always see in the paper, you know, a quote from somebody about a loved one that's passed on, and they say he's gone to a better place.
Yeah.
I wish it were true that dying means going to a better place.
This one,
it
I
doesn't.
Am so with you. It is
It's
incredible.
Like, why are we all so sad when somebody dies, or why do we not want to die ourselves? Because it's almost selfish to think that you're going to a better place.
Well,
I mean,
wait, but that part of it may be, when you say, why are we so sad, it's because you're not with that person,
yes.
even if they are going to a better place, but you don't believe they go to a better place
no.
anyway. They're going no place. Is that
yeah.
what you're
I mean,
thinking?
You're still part of the earth. If there's any, you know, kind of...
I got it.
You know, resolve to that, you know, at least you're here, you know, your DNA is here in mm-hmm. one form or another, but you're not going to a better place.
Okay.
I think that's what
is
else
Is there an upbeat one in this list or not?
Well, here's one.
These are things, Emily, wishes
were true,
but apparently are not.
You know, we spend a lot of time debating things and, you know, trying to convince people of things. And I wish it were true that a debate could change people's minds.
Yeah.
You know, even any kind of a debate, you know, whether it was political or even the discussion we had in the beginning of the show here about
gay marriage.
People who are against it, you know, they don't like it, so they're against it. But you're not going to be able to change your mind, even though Sue O'Connell did the most genius explanation of why gay people have the same rights as anybody else.
The question that Kohler said, is it okay in 2014 to be against gay marriage? And her response, if you missed the beginning, it's fine personally to have any position on any issue. It is not fine for the government to discriminate against
right.
that anybody. It was beautifully put. But I don't. This is the first one I don't agree with you on. There are a lot of issues, particularly emotional ones like that, where people are locked in place. But as evidenced by the fact that we went from 30-some approval of gay marriage 10 years ago to 55% approval, some people have changed their mind, not just people died away and are replaced. Isn't that true?
I don't know. I almost think some people have come to accept it, which is different than being on board with it. And they say, all right, that's part of the landscape now. But do they embrace it? Do they actually accept it? No.
Yeah, this is a good example, as one of our producers just said in my ear, we're debating this and we're not
yeah,
changing our positions.
Exactly, there you go.
So I guess it does prove your point.
Well, that was my upbeat one.
That was the upbeat one?
Yeah.
What, the debate doesn't change anybody's mind?
Yeah.
So why do you do what you do? What's the point of what you do then? I assume you're part of why you do what you do and have done it brilliantly for your whole life mm-hmm. is because if you inform and educate people, then it allows them to make decisions that...
People hear. I think they listen. I didn't say they don't change their minds, but most people are kind of, it's like the flame to moth, they're drawn to the argument that they agree with most,
yeah.
which is why, you know, people are
you
turning
watch Fox News
Bill
if they're conservative,
O'Reilly
watch
or MSNBC.
Okay,
so that's that kind of, you know, that niche knowledge, and you sort of go to where your niche is. And
okay.
But, you know, I think we get a lot of tune in, sort of turnaround here on public radio, and I think that's really true. We sort of cut across large because you do hear so many different voices and different
yeah.
kinds of debate. And I think people like to tune in, but whether you're going to convince them, I don't know.
I think most things that I have spoken to have changed people's minds and generally to oppose what my position is. Is that the end of it? You've put
yeah,
it
I
down.
Yeah, I know. It was a little...
It was brief.
It was brief.
And it was
I'm
really depressing,
that
by
was.
The way.
I
really,
next week's is going to be much more
It
upbeat.
Is. Do we know what it is?
I
you
do.
Never tease. Oh, can you give us a hint or you don't want to give us a hint?
No, I'm not telling you. Jared's going to be here next week. Are you here next week?
No, I'm actually...
Actually, through. I'm not here next week.
Okay, fine. Oh,
I'm typing it, though. That's
okay,
it.
Fine. Why don't we have this discussion on the air for the next 3 minutes, figuring out who's going to be in the studio, who is not. In any case, that was Emily Rooney with Emily's List. When she is here, we do that on Fridays. Coming up, it's our Friday news quiz. And this is great, Emily.
This is going to be wonderful.
What happens when two guys with the same name and the same quirky profession challenge each other over the week's headlines? You're going to find out next, 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
The J. general goes on the offensive.
Any allegation, any adverse incident like this makes me mad as hell.
VA Secretary Eric Shinseki before Congress as reports of adverse incidents at the VA proliferate. Next time, a whistleblower in Missouri on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH Radio exists because of you and Northeastern University, where researchers are mapping people's travel patterns to forecast pandemics, giving global health policy a new direction. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow. And Bonhams International Auctioneers and Appraisers, Bonhams specialists in fine art, jewelry, and motor cars, will be visiting Boston to provide confidential estimates for upcoming New York auctions. More at bonhams.com/boston.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody, Emily Rooney sitting in for Marjorie, and this should be interesting. Here
with us
in Studio 3 for our Friday News Quiz is Rick Roth, thankfully. He's the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Cape Ann Vernal Pond Team. Rick, it's good to see you.
Hi, Jim.
And also sitting across from Rick Roth is Rick Roth, who is the founder of Creature Teachers. Great to have you too, Rick. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Now, can you give us a little bit of the history here?
Yeah.
There's a Globe story that is brilliant, by the way, by, I don't even know what they got. What's the name of the person we have in front of us?
Nikki Cataldo.
Nikki Cataldo. Oh, actually, he's a volunteer with you,
she.
Right? She. So, oops, sorry. Now, Rick Roth, speaking, you're a Gloucester kind of guy. Had you heard of each other before you actually were brought together by this woman? What's the deal?
Yes. I think 25 years ago or something, there was an article about Rick in Mass Wildlife magazine, and somebody gave it to me because they said, look, this guy's got your name. He's a critter guy, and he's also a carver. I dabble
carver.
In wood carving.
Like wood carving, yeah. Did you think it was you for a second, or
did
you
not.
Knew it was not you?
They had pictures of the carvings in there, and he's far more,
far
better carver than I am.
How long before you guys actually met Rick Roth from Littleton? How long before did you actually hear the other Rick?
That was actually, not more than a month ago, actually.
Really?
We had heard about each other for a long, long time. The way I found out about him was I saw a newspaper article somebody sent me and said, great job. And I was reading it and said, this sounds like me, but there was something quite different about it. And I got to the end, and there was a photograph there of a girl holding a snake. And I did not recognize the snake, so I knew it wasn't mine. Mm-hmm. And so I said, this is somebody else.
And so finally,
don't you do different kinds of critters, though? Rick Roth, you do more snakes and stuff?
Snakes and
some of which he's brought
critters.
With him,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, sitting right
but
next
we'll get to
me.
In a minute. And what was the other thing, snakes and what?
Vernal pool critters, a lot of frogs and salamanders.
Oh, I'm okay with those.
And what do you do, Rick?
We do everything. We go from bugs all the way to mammals, wallabies, coatimundis, lots of birds, things like that.
Rick Roth, I'm holding in my hand, mm-hmm. sort of, there's a plastic thing around it, two of these incredibly beautiful little thing with yellow spots. What are these babies?
That is
here?
The spotted salamander.
Oh, my God. They're really beautiful.
Kind of a poster boy for vernal pools because
they
only use that habitat to breed. We use those in our programs.
Mm-hmm. What do
so
you mean?
Do
what
both of you go around to schools? What is the idea?
Yeah. Schools. We do a lot of libraries, senior centers, that kind of thing.
Same deal with you, Rick Roth?
Similar. I usually don't do many schools because I'm a carpenter and I'm at work when kids are in school. Mm. But we do a lot of state parks and libraries and basically any place they'll have us.
Now, maybe we should do a few questions. And then tell us, just to give you a heads up, because I am snake phobic, but I'm going to try to man up here. What kind of snakes did you bring?
I got a couple of milk snakes. One of them is for Rick. He was telling me the other month when we saw each other that he didn't have an Eastern milk snake.
You're going to give him an Eastern milk snake?
I'm going to give it to him.
That's really? You're going to do it now? Why don't you do it now? We can.
Oh, my God.
Don't ask me to hand
here's
it.
The,
do not,
I will not
even come close.
I will not torture you.
It's Rick Roth with a milk snake.
What we have here is this is a cloth bag like a pillowcase, and it's a good way to travel.
Just reaching
a snake.
In there.
They
like
can breathe right through there. Snakes like it when they think they're hiding. They're very secretive animals.
Actually, it's pretty.
They're a pretty snake, and for the most part, pretty calm. Mm. I rescued this out of somebody's deer guard.
It's a
plastic mesh that that people use to keep deer from eating their plants. And,
now, if I were to touch it, I know it's not its back, whatever it's called. Can I just touch it?
Sure
so
you
I'm
can.
Not a total.
What do they
oh,
eat?
Actually, not a total
what
coward,
this guy
I
eat?
Guess. Okay,
they eat mostly rodents.
You do?
Want to try that?
Nah.
No.
Why don't you hand it to... We have
I
a,
will.
Will, our colleague, is don't let it be moving around like that. He's what a nice gift from Rick to Rick.
Yes.
Now, how do you feel about that?
I think that's wonderful because we've been looking for one of these for our programs. Sometimes we will get one in the spring and we will release it in the fall on my property. So we're not taking it anywhere to let it go. But we generally don't winter any of these over, so it's nice to be able to have one, use it for our summer programs.
So what are you going to put this in your pocket and take it
probably,
home? Probably,
yeah.
Do?
I think we'll probably put it
put back
in the cloth bag,
book.
Yeah.
Before we start, I keep saying one last thing before we start here. He's handing you the little pillowcase or whatever it is here. In the story that was in the Boston Globe, I think you both told stories about getting bitten.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
It seemed, even though it was not a video, it was a written thing, that you were smiling and laughing when telling the stories. What is either funny or amusing about getting bitten by a fisher cat or whatever you do? Or a starting with you, Rick Roth.
Well, I guess it's just all part of the job. And we know going into this that this is something that we're going to have to deal with. Just the other day, I got bitten by a macaw right in the face.
Yeah. Oh,
just
I hate
before,
that when it happens.
I know, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just before I had to go and do a program. So I was bleeding profusely and had to put styptic powder on it. And when I did, it turned the injury black. So I had to show up at a senior center with this big bite mark on my face. And unfortunately, it's just one of the things. It's a hazard of the job we do.
Do you have the same fatalistic point of view, Rick Roth?
I've been getting bit by snakes for over 50 years on pretty much a daily basis. And it means nothing to me, pretty much.
Is it painful?
If it's a big snake and it's got big teeth, it can be.
Yeah, I would think so.
But they're
not poisonous.
I've never been bitten by a venomous snake, no.
Hmm. Okay.
In the comics, I told them you'd be cool to play with the snakes.
I was. I touched the thing.
You were playing with it.
Are you not even touching it, Emily?
Not yet.
I'd like to say one last thing here. Now that you've finally met after all these years of confusion about, and by the way, the last names are spelled exactly the same, if that's not obvious. It's spelled like Roth, even though one says Roth. Are you friends now? I mean, you're going to hang out?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we
This is
we
Rick
hit it
Roth,
off,
by so. The way. I guess we have to be clear. Of Littleton. Yes, go ahead, Rick
Littleton,
Roth.
Littleton, yeah. When we first met, finally, we really hit it off, and we were sitting there for hours just
really?
Kind of talking about, what do you do in this situation or what do you do in that situation? And so we find that, it's like we see each other now and say, hey, how's it going,
Since I get Rick Roth, you don't like him as much as he likes you. Is that a safe assumption or no?
Big snakes
not at all.
Around in there, Jim.
Okay, there is? Yeah, tell us how much you like him.
We did a photo shoot at his place. He invited us to come there, and then we went and saw his animals, and we had just a great time out there, and I've invited him to come to my house where I keep my 65 snakes.
65.
Now, before we're going to start the quiz in 30 seconds, but what other kind of snake are we going to see today? Don't bring it out yet. I got to get adjusted.
Another milk snake in there, a different variety, and also a pine snake native to the eastern United States.
How about that python was found in the woman's bathroom the other day? Did you go rescue that?
Somebody did, but it wasn't me.
That's ridiculous.
Okay, let's start.
All right, are we ready?
Now, I was going to say I could make a poor joke and say, why don't you ask your question of Rick? Okay, fine. Why don't you do Littleton Rick, and I will do Gloucester Rick.
All right, so this is Littleton to my left.
You ready, Rick?
Okay, Rick, you ready?
Yeah.
Here is Stephen Colbert weighing in on the latest news from the Vatican.
Pope Moonbeam over here has driven his welcome wagon where no pope has gone before, because at Mass on Monday, the pontiff said, if, for example, tomorrow an expedition of came, and one says, but I want to be baptized, who are we to close doors? You heard that right, folks. Pope Francis would baptize a Of course, first, he has to convert them from Scientology.
All right, question to Rick from Littleton. Who did Pope Francis say he would baptize?
Oh, I have absolutely no idea.
This is a hard one to
I
start.
Wouldn't have known this either.
You want to steal this, Rick Roth? Do you have any idea who he said he'd baptize? He doesn't want to.
I wouldn't know this one either.
Martians.
Answer's Martians.
Oh, okay.
That was
makes sense.
One.
That was tough.
Okay, you don't
That's
get
zero.
Any points for that. Now, thank you. That was cruel the way you put
that
it there,
cruel.
Emily. But, okay, here's your opportunity, Rick Roth. You're from Gloucester, by the way. That's not fair to people either. Here's Barbara Walters spoofing herself last week on Saturday Night Live. Listen.
Do not be afraid to ask the tough questions like,
If you were a tree, what kind of a tree would you be?
Good for her. Okay, why is Barbara Walters in the news this week, Rick Roth?
I thought it was because she was retiring.
That is exactly why. Very, very impressive. Very, you're up 1-0.
Rick knew that.
Yeah, did you know that, Rick?
That was the only thing I knew.
We'll give it to Rick, too. All right.
How's that going to do for your friendship that you got one right? So we'll see what happens.
Touch and go now.
Back to Rick Roth.
All right, here we go to Rick Roth from Littleton. Who's Conan O'Brien talking about here?
I don't know if you saw this. It was on ESPN after being drafted by the St. Louis Rams, celebrated by kissing his boyfriend. Yeah. Yeah. Now, some NFL players actually criticize for kissing his boyfriend. Yeah, apparently NFL players aren't supposed to be in a gay relationship until they're sent to prison. Then it's okay. Then it's fine. Did I lose you that quickly?
Okay.
I hate to say this, I forgot his name.
Yeah,
but.
Name
give us
really
describe him as best you can.
Yeah, he was the gay player that was drafted this week in the NFL.
Is that good enough, judges? We're giving it to him.
Well,
yes,
what about
we
Rick over here? Do you have the name?
I think his last name was Sam.
That's good.
So how do we do that, judges? You decide who you give points to. We'll figure it out later. Okay, here's your question, Rick Roth. And the reason we're doing this, if you just tuned in, is they're both, well, they're spelled Rick Roth, even though one says Roth. I assume he's an uppity kind of guy. I don't know what the deal is. But they're both in the animal world. Can I say, is that a fair way to describe
it?
Sure. They're sort of in the animal world. They'd gotten each other correspondence, read about each other in the newspaper, names spelled the same way. They'd never met until a few weeks ago, and the Globe brought them together, and now they're the best of friends. Okay, you ready for this, Rick Roth?
I am.
Thank you. Here's late-night host Jimmy Fallon on some celebrity news. Listen up.
You guys hear about this? Yesterday, our buddy, Alec Baldwin, got busted for and then arguing about it with the cops. That's right. He was charged with 2 counts of being Alec Baldwin. I mean, that's what he does.
Here's the question, you know, Rick Roth. Alec Baldwin was charged with arguing with a cop. What else was he arrested for the other day?
Some misdemeanor. I don't know.
Okay, Rick Roth, do you know that you can steal this entire...
Riding the bicycle on the wrong...
All right!
Whoa, yes! Right. It is. Judges, is it tied? I don't know what it is. But okay, it's tied, apparently.
That's a good one. Tied.
Okay, let's...
Two to one and a half.
Let's see another snake, Rick Roth. What do you got there?
Oh, boy.
Okay. Okay, this one is in a plaid bag, just for those of you who are not watching on television. Yeah, this looks a little larger.
Yes, it's a lot larger.
Okay... Oh my God.
This is Skip.
See, that is Skip. This is a large snake.
He's like 4 feet.
He's in five. Yeah. Maybe six. He's a northern pine snake. And,
he's kind of pretty.
He's about 17 years old. I hatched this thing.
What?
Is that true?
Where are they indigenous to?
Eastern United States, but not quite as far north. Yeah. New Jersey's about as far north as they get.
And they're in the wild? I've never seen anything like that in the wild.
Well, no, you've got to get out more.
Oh.
Now, wait a second. So you've lived with this.
Rough scales.
Rough skills. Right, oh, actually, they are.
Yeah. Touch
Emily's touching this one, too. Oh, wow. What was that like?
Yeah.
Okay, now, you've been with a snake for 17 and a half years, correct?
Sort of, kind of, yeah.
That's my question. Does he recognize you?
No. I don't think so.
Meaning if Rick Roth were to come into the room, he would assume just another human being? Is that it?
Yeah, I think so.
How do you know that he doesn't recognize you?
Well, I don't, but I can tell you that this snake probably would never meet his parents in the wild.
Why?
The females lay the eggs and then crawl away.
Oh, they do.
There's no parental care among snakes, and it's just not in their program to say, oh, this guy's caring for me. I think
attachment.
I'll know who he is.
Now, I knew this when I was six, but I don't know it at this age. Why do all these snakes do the tongue-out thing nonstop?
That's how they smell.
Oh, it is smell?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't know. It actually is beautiful.
It is
really
is
quite
gorgeous.
Beautiful.
It's white. How would you describe it? White with...
Brown. Black blotches, saddles.
But it's a very uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We haven't had snakes in the studio in days. It's really, it's really, okay.
I've lost my place. Where are we?
At the end of 2 rounds, it apparently is Rick Roth, 2 points, judges, and Rick Roth, 1.5 points. And what's the name of the thing, Skip?
Skip.
Okay. How do you name these babies here?
It's hard to say because sometimes it just
comes to you. Yeah.
Sometimes the school kids or somebody will name it and it'll stick.
Oh, that's nice.
It just depends.
Okay. You can put it back in the bag now.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Here we go.
Rick Roth
Next
from Emily Rooney.
Rick Roth.
Yeah.
All right.
It's beautiful. Actually.
Here's a newscast from earlier this week. What exactly was airborne?
2 boys from South Glens Falls are being treated at Albany Med tonight. They were playing in when airborne, taking them for a ride, a harrowing ride.
This is an incredible story.
Yes. What went airborne, Rick?
One of those hoppy houses.
Yes.
Wow.
Bouncy house, they call it. That's excellent.
Do you know, it says three kids were playing in it when a gust of wind sent it flying. The other kids fell from a height of 15 to 20 feet. Have you seen the video of the thing blowing away in the air?
Seen
it's
it.
Unbelievable. In any case, he has enlarged his lead. But Rick Roth, you can close that baby up. And by the way, Rick Roth brought snakes. Rick Roth didn't.
Exactly.
Give him a half
him
a point for that. Okay. Really, I mean, it was
is
your own choice.
Is this bag supposed to be empty?
No, but you didn't bring it. It was gifted to you.
Nice.
By the way, what other weird stuff, before I ask you, what's the weirdest animal or something that's in your repertoire there, Rick Roth? What do you bring to parties or events or libraries? What do you got there?
Most people think it's rattlesnakes.
Yeah.
You bring rattlesnakes?
Yeah.
Okay. How about you,
Rick?
Those
I have run into in the wild.
Yeah?
Many times.
Terrifying.
Lake George, which is near South Glens Falls.
I know it is. How about you, Rick Roth? What have you got going on there?
Well, we've got some strange things, but probably right now is our armadillo, Doug.
Do you know what?
Armadillo.
This is a quiz. You get no points for this. What governor had a stuffed of Massachusetts? No points for either of you. A stuffed armadillo in his office when he was governor not so long ago. Very popular governor.
Not so long ago.
Not so in the last, let's say, 20 years, 20 plus years. Who was it? Very popular, very tall, red hair.
Oh, wow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That guy. Okay, Bill Weld. Thank you very much.
Bill Weld.
Okay, you get no points. Here's your, this is a question for you, Rick Roth. This announcement is sure to make tourists happy this summer. Please have a listen, if you would.
It's been closed since August 23rd, 2011, when a 5.8 magnitude earthquake shook the marble and granite, sending debris flying.
And we have one of the most spectacular views in America, and certainly the best view in Washington, D.C., and we're very excited to allow visitors back up at this level.
A little high energy
that
PR
was kind of
there.
A lot of giveaway in that one.
Okay, but here it is. What were they talking about in that clip, Rick Roth?
I'm going to take a stab at the Washington Monument.
That is exactly correct.
We should have clipped to Washington, D.C. out of
well,
that.
Then you do the quiz, Emily, if you don't have the questions.
too many hints in that one.
She's a visitor sitting in for Marjorie, and she's critiquing our work here.
You know.
Okay, you can do another one to Rick Roth. This is pretty exciting match,
one,
by the way.
Is this one easy, too? All right. What historical relic may have been rediscovered? Here's a clue.
In 1492, Columbus sailed the Ocean Blue. Christmas Day, the crew fell asleep in the sunk ocean deep. May 13th, 2014, a man found the ship on the ocean floor. That man is Barry Clifford, and he believes wreckage found off the coast of Haiti is that of Christopher Columbus's 500-year-old flagship.
Question.
Mayflower?
Mayflower? Christopher Columbus.
Oh, Nina.
Well,
close.
Judges, do we give any points for that or we don't?
Yeah.
Apparently they say no. Do you know what it is, Rick Roth?
It's flagship. I'm going to go with Santa Maria.
Yes,
you
excellent.
Get the points. That was very
nicely
done.
We're really evening it out here.
Well, I'll tell you, it's very exciting.
This is good.
Here's the last question before the bonus round, which is really going to get intense. Who was let go from a prominent leadership position this week, Rick Roth?
It's very meaningful to me that I'm the first woman to be executive editor of some of the male journalists who interviewed me were almost afraid to ask the question. They almost said to me, I know I'm not supposed to ask this, but they'd ask me then a gender-related question. I'm so proud of the fact that I am the first woman to hold this job.
Okay, who was that go from a prominent leader position? She lost her job this week. Who was that?
I got to go with Barbara Walters again.
No.
Well, that actually is a great answer. That'd be wrong.
No, this woman got fired.
Rick Roth, do you have any idea?
From GM?
Well, she should be, Mary Barra, but that's not the right answer either. So neither of you get it. It's Jill Abramson, now the former executive editor of the New York Times.
Did you see the news this afternoon? She just pulled out. She was supposed to be the keynote speaker.
Oh, Brandeis, right?
She pulled out.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Did you see the photograph on Instagram? Her daughter took a picture of her with boxing gloves on, with a New York Yankees hat and a New York City token tattoo on her shoulder. It's really...
Is it real? Maybe one of
those I think it is real, actually. In any case...
She's got an odd speech pattern.
Okay, well, I'd say so. Now, what is the score going into the bonus round? 3-4. Who's ahead? Littleton is ahead.
Rick...
Roth is ahead.
Oh, we're getting confused
Gloucester here. Rick is ahead.
Bonus round.
Littleton Rick. Now, here's how it works. Since you're both named Rick Ross, we're going to ask you about the hip-hop... We're going to ask you about the hip-hop giant Rick Ross, and here's some of his music to get in the spirit of it.
Every day I'm hustling, every day I'm hustling, every day I'm hustling. Who you suck?
Okay, enough of Rick Ross. By the way, he loves snakes, from what I understand. Now, we change the order here. Emily, you ask Rick Roth.
Okay, I'm going to ask Rick Roth
the first question. Go ahead.
Rick Ross has recently secured an interim gig as what? An advice columnist for Rolling Stone, the chief image officer for Gucci, his hip-hop artist in residence at Juilliard.
A, B, or C, Rick?
Advice columnist Rolling Stone, chief image officer for Gucci, hip-hop artist in residence at Juilliard.
B.
I'd be wrong. Thank you for that, judges. That's a little demeaning. Do you want to steal that, Rick?
I'm going to say A.
Yep.
You said
advice
correct.
Columnist.
That's amazing.
For Rolling Stone.
So is it tie now, judges? This is really
this
exciting.
Is tense.
It is really great. Now, Rick, who's this go to? Oh, Rick Roth. You can take the lead, Rick Roth. I know this is confusing to you at home. Believe me, it's confusing to us here, too. One has snakes, one does. Well, actually, he does now, too.
Yeah.
Rick Ross has become a respected rapper by depicting the life of a drug boss. However, in 2008, something threatened his street cred. What was it? This is, again, a multiple choice. A, proof that he had once been a manager at Radio Shack. B, proof that he had worked as a dog groomer. Or C, proof that he had worked as a corrections officer. A, B, or C, Rick Roth?
I'm going to say C.
That is correct.
That's good. Yeah.
So he has a lead of 1 point going into the final question. So, Emily, when you ask this question of Rick Roth, if he gets it right, it is tie between Brand New Friends.
And if not?
He gets it wrong, it's the end of everything.
You're taking a snake
exactly.
All right, okay, question three for the tie. In an interview with Corey Coco Brother Condry, Rick Ross said he was a Christian and he substantiated his claim. How? By saying he prays before every performance? By saying that his last name, Ross, rhymes with cross? By saying that when he goes on the road, he brings along bottles of his church's communion wine? Praying before a performance, name rhymes with cross, bringing wine with him on the road.
If it was me, I'd go with C.
Well, it is you.
I would.
You are you. Is that what you go with?
Yeah.
You're wrong.
It's wrong.
Okay. Now, but wait a second. You know what we're going to do here? If you get this wrong, we're going to take away a point. So the pressure is on you. No, I changed the rules. I'm in charge of the quiz. It's either A or B. Is that right, Emily?
Yep.
Read the choices.
By saying he prays before every performance or saying his name, Ross, rhymes with cross.
What do you think?
I'm going to have to say A.
Excellent.
What do you think, judges? He's the winner. Congratulations.
The winner.
Give him a snake. Now, if people...
I think we've got more snakes.
Oh, we have
too.
One more milk. Let's see. We have enough time for this. Is it another milk or what is the deal here? What's the difference between the first milk snake and the second milk snake?
Bigger.
You're going to find out.
Yeah. This one's big, I can tell.
This is Rick Roth. He's from Gloucester.
I have no concern at all about reaching into that bag.
Oh wow.
Beautiful. It's red.
This is a Nelson's milk snake from Mexico. There's milk snakes all across the Americas. And it's basically the same species, just a different subspecies from the eastern milk.
It's got terracotta colors for those of you who can't see it.
It's totally beautiful. How old is this one?
Six.
How do you know? If you didn't, you said you knew the first snake. Yeah.
I got
the
this
second
as a hatchling.
Oh, as a hatchling.
I bought it, but
it was a
hatchling.
If you didn't get it as a hatchling and you just purchased the full, do you have any way to know?
You can only guess.
You can only guess.
How long do they live?
I'm expecting this snake to live 20 years anyway.
Wow. And what do they die of?
they can get diseases and stuff like that, and they can get, you know, osteoporosis type things and stuff like that, kind of. Not exactly people things, but sort of, kind of.
So this guy is an earth color, sort of a rusty earth color with black, with white stripes around the middle. Black
stripe
and a white band.
Stripes go this way on a snake.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. You know,
they're bands.
So you don't embarrass yourself in front
exactly.
of a bunch of herpetologists someday. You know.
It's a band, not a stripe. It's
okay, now if we want to find either of you, if they're libraries, they're kids groups, they're whatever, starting with you, Rick Roth, how do people find you in the world?
Well, we have a website.
Well, will that be one way?
CapeAnnVernalPond.org.
Wait, give me that again?
CapeAnnVernalPond.org.
What's a vernal pond, by the way?
A temporary wetland.
Okay.
And they're important because they don't have any fish because they're temporary.
Oh, that's a
so that
good
gives
point,
them a unique ecology.
Thank you for telling me that. Now, Rick Roth, what's your deal? How do we find you and associated kinds of things?
Well, you can find me by my webpage, too, which is thecreatureteachers.com.
Thecreatureteachers.com, yeah.
Yeah, and... we do all kinds of programs for schools and libraries and senior centers and
Do you rent yourselves out? Is that how it works?
Not really, no, not like
that. You do
that.
It for free?
We do. No, well, no, we yeah. charge, but what we do is we'll do a program. Usually programs are about an hour long, depending on what we do. Mm-hmm. And those are with all kinds of different animals, all kinds of different environments.
And do you let your guests touch them? Do they?
Some animals we do. Some require special permits that have stipulations on them. Say we can't let people touch things. And if we mess anything up, we just say we're from Gloucester.
Rick Ross from Gloucester and Rick Roth, new friends, courtesy of the Boston Globe and to a little lesser degree, WGBH. You're from Littleton. It's a pleasure to meet both of you. You were great, and congratulations on your – was it a – oh, no, you won, Rick Ross. Congratulations.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you.
And you were a warrior in this, Rick Ross. It's good
to
see you.
It's touch and go there.
It was touch and go. It was.
Even Stephen for – all right. Well, thank
you
both.
I touched all three
snakes
and only touched one, let me be clear.
All right. Tonight, beat the press.
What are you doing? Quickly, what are you doing?
Barbara Walters. For one thing, and we're doing a piece on Jill Abramson, which is getting more interesting by the moment because, you know, she could have been fired because she was complaining about her salary. Mm-hmm. So there's more and more
gender pay equity
stuff
thing
coming out about that. It's a good issue. All right. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for Philippe Petit. Is that how you say his name?
Philippe Petit. He's the guy who walked between the two
World Trade Centers. I remember him.
Man on wire. I can't wait. We're going to do our political panel, too. Shannon Ryan, Charlie Chippier. Emily, it's been a pleasure.
Marjorie
as
will
always.
Be back Monday.
She'll be back Monday, so will I. Have a wonderful weekend. See you soon.